Don't talk to strangers. They may be killers. Brush right after you eat, or your gums will start to bleed in your sleep and choke you.
Beth.
What?
In a place called Hollywood.
Wow, this is crazy.
This Christmas, from Oscar winner James L. Brooks, creator of Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, comes a comedy that breaks all the rules. Wow. Nick Nolte.
What good is
I'm actually afraid of my own kid.
Albert Brooks. Julie Kavner. Jolie Richardson. Tracy Ullman, and introducing Whitney Wright.
She's lucky to have a daddy who cares.
I'll do anything.
You like the juice?
Like the juice.
No, I'm going to cut that song out when I edit this podcast. I didn't like the way he sang it. I thought it slowed the podcast down, so I'm just going to furiously edit that song out of the podcast. Because it didn't test well with podcast
listeners. Don't worry, I'll put it in my vault, so when I die of a drug overdose, they'll release it after my death.
Ah, well, no one knows what we're talking about, because we never introduced this podcast. Welcome to Saturday Night Jive.
We only ever introduce it like half the time anyway.
I know, and sometimes like 15 minutes in. But sometimes I remember to do it, and I'm like, we're on it. Professional fucking podcast this week. Welcome to Saturday Night Jive. I'm George.
I'm Ben, and we talk about, well, you say professional podcast. We've long since abandoned the premise. This is probably the most fucking not Saturday Night Live movie I think we've ever watched.
If you like, I just want to know what the stranger who listens to our podcast thinks. Like, some guy going like, you know, I love Saturday Night Live. Ooh, here's one because the description on iTunes still says, like, two brothers talk about SNL. He's like, ooh, I loved Chadwick Boseman hosted last week. I wonder what this podcast will enlighten my ears to. And we're like, hey, Harry Shearer was in 2 seconds of I'll Do Anything. That's why we're talking about it.
Man.
So this is the podcast where we pick a an SNL cast member's name out of a hat, watch a movie they're in.
But not necessarily a Saturday Night Live movie.
No.
In fact, I think we even did it once? No, it's Pat. I think that's the only actual SNL movie we've watched.
Okay, so now the introduction to our podcast is basically just
apologizing
for having the podcast on. That'll be our new sign on. Welcome to Saturday Night Jive. We're already sorry.
And I think no more than today when we have to talk about I'll Do Anything.
Oh, God, now we've met at our podcast, like, James.
No one will ever fucking watch. Like, because sometimes I'm like, hey, maybe they'll watch along. So, like, how much do I want to spoil? How much do I want to talk about? How crazy do I want to make this? No one is ever going to fucking watch this movie.
And then we worry about spoilers for a movie 25 fucking years old that no one saw in the first place. And no one saw the real movie. That man, the trivia behind this movie
is more interesting than the movie.
It's way more interesting than the movie. If it wasn't for the trivia of I'll Do Anything, we would have just watched I'll Do Anything and been like, what the fuck did we just watch? Yeah. Nick Nolte raised a kid for like 2 hours.
But it's fascinating to watch in the same way that like Master of Disguise was, like, watching, like, what did they cut and how did they edit this weird fucking Frankenstein of a movie?
To the point where, my God, man, I feel like my life won't matter unless I see the musical version of I'll Do Anything.
Yeah, so if you don't know this movie, it was directed by James L. Brooks, written and directed by James L. Brooks, I believe.
Yes.
And it was originally conceived as a musical. Like a screwball comedy thing?
I don't know. Well, not knowing what the songs were like, too.
Well, they were written by Prince and Carole King.
Yeah. But, like, I'm also thinking of it as, like, a musical, like a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, you know? So, I mean, we're imagining that when Nick Nolte's like, I don't know how to raise my kid, he'll cut to, I don't know how to raise my kid.
Okay, but what else is it? So then you're saying it's just a lot of music that was cut?
Maybe.
Because they call it a musical. You can't call it a musical unless somebody's singing on screen.
I know, and I just, after watching this version of this movie, I cannot imagine what it would be like if I saw the actual musical version and I watched the same movie, but just randomly Nick Nolte just starts singing.
The tone of the movie, 90% of which was presumably present in the musical version, is not the tone of a musical.
No.
And we should point out that the reason it's not a musical is because apparently there was a horrible test screening, so James L. Brooks furiously edited all the musical scenes out and re-edited it with, I guess, what did he say, 17 minutes or something?
He said he reshot for 4 days.
Yeah.
Which isn't a lot in movie time. No. I mean, because they, you know, when you set up a fucking shot, a scene takes all day.
Yeah.
So 4 days of reshoots is not anything. So I'm imagining this is the movie, except there were just fucking songs. And it's already a 2-hour movie. So are you telling me that there's like a... this was like a 2.5-hour fucking musical?
Well, because let's say if it was a 2-hour musical, he cut out the music and then added enough. But you couldn't have filmed in 4 days enough to compensate for cutting out several musical numbers.
Yeah.
There's no way that's possible. I don't know what the fuck happened.
I'm guessing the reshoots were just basically bridging material. Like if there was exposition in a song or something, he probably was like, oh shit, I have to put a scene in here where you learn that.
I'm wondering if he maybe filled some time with like alternate takes of stuff that he otherwise had cut.
Maybe. Well, because there's also not a lot of plot to this movie, so a lot of the scenes
by the end of this movie, we were like, when the fuck is this movie gonna start? Oh, it's almost over, okay.
Oh my god, yeah, we got 13 minutes in and I was like, well, what's the ending of this movie gonna be? Nothing's fucking happened. Nothing's happened in this movie. And then what was the ending? They're just like, all right, cool.
Yeah, I guess he has a daughter, which he's had through the whole movie, and they like each other.
Well, it's like there's no stakes to this movie. Also, is this movie Nick Nolte's movie, or is this Albert Brooks and Julie Kavner's movie?
That's the other thing. I wondered if maybe they bumped up the Julie Kavner, Albert Brooks stuff.
Oh, maybe they reshot more of that to cover... that would make sense, because for half of this movie, I was like, am I watching a Nick Nolte movie? Because it starts with Nick Nolte, so that's what I assume. Am I watching a Nick Nolte movie with an Albert Brooks subplot? Or am I watching an Albert Brooks movie with a Nick Nolte subplot?
Well, because Nick Nolte has the kid, I feel like you have to say it's Nick Nolte's movie.
And the movie begins and ends with Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
But there's so many scenes with Albert Brooks and Julie Kavner
that don't relate to the Nick Nolte stuff at all.
Have nothing to fucking do with Nick Nolte's story.
Well, because, okay, here's the whatever plot there is. Nick Nolte's a struggling, out-of-work actor. He was nominated for an Emmy at one point in the 80s in the parallel reality where every other Emmy nomination was real from the real broadcast except for his.
Oh.
Because, like, Powers Booth wins for Guiana Tragedy, which he did in real life.
Right. And so it's Powers Booth, Gregory Peck, I don't know, fucking
is it possible
Martin
Nick
Landau.
Nolte was nominated for an Emmy that year and they just switched out the
no,
role?
No, I did look that up in the IMDb
He's
trivia.
Never been nominated
it
for
said
an Emmy.
Nick Nolte was not nominated for an Emmy that year. But they did use the footage of Powers Booth's real Emmy win.
Yeah. But basically, he's an out-of-work actor, and then, like, 6 years after that, he has a kid, but he's divorced. They gotta just, like, skip past the whole ending of their marriage.
What the hell? Tracy Ullman's character was basically just a baby delivery service for Nick Nolte. We never get any closure on what the fuck happened to Tracy Ullman. We never figure, what did she fucking do?
Well, the weird thing is, in the beginning, they're establishing her as, like, a kind of an interesting character. Like, when she's legitimately mad about him not winning the Emmy, like, blaming him. And it's like, that's kind of a weird perspective to have if you're in a relationship.
Oh, yeah. That made no sense to me the first scene of this movie.
If you're, like, a shallow person, maybe you're only dating him because you think he's going to be a successful actor. That's what I kind of took from that. But then once you go through, you realize, I think the idea is just that she's kind of crazy. Because when you see her with the kid later on, she's like a weird, like, fucking... well, she's being arrested by federal marshals for something. But, like, the way she reacts to people and to her kid, like, she's like a really weird, like, cloistered mother. Like, she reminded me of the mom from Carrie, almost.
Yeah. Like, probably Nell's mother. Like, raising your fucking kids in the backwoods, teaching them only to
respect
you.
Well, like, I think
you.
She homeschools the kid. I don't think that she has ever gone to school, nor does Nick Nolte take her to school at any point for some reason.
This kid lives just in an apartment
with Nick
Nolte.
She doesn't know how to read. She's 6 years old, which it's a little too old to not know how to read.
She doesn't know how to read. But that's not what the movie's about.
No.
The movie's not about teaching my kid how to read. The movie's about making your kid a fucking movie star.
At the end of it, she gets to the point where she's cast in a show and she would have to read scripts. And she's like, do I have to learn how to read scripts or read to be in the on TV? And they're like, no, they'll just read it to you. Right. I don't fucking think that's real.
But then this movie is about just a kid who does not know how to read, and they're just going like, oh no, instead of teaching you to read, we should put you out on this movie set and get you work as an actor. Like, these are despicable people then.
But more than that, Nick Nolte even references the fact that it's really a really bad idea for her to be a child actor, and then just goes, okay, I guess she is, even though I'm her father and have to sign off on this.
Right.
And then he's like, isn't it great how great of a child actor you are?
Yeah. That's the ending of the movie. The ending of the movie is...
None of this movie makes fucking sense.
Nick Nolte got what he didn't want, but it's a happy ending. Okay, so it's weird because I know this movie just from the poster. It's Nick Nolte with a kid, so I'm like, all right, I know what this movie's about. It's Nick Nolte raising his kid.
And I would argue there's a lot of sweet moments, too, with the father and daughter.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what the movie's about. The movie's just about nothing. The movie's about fucking nothing.
Well, it doesn't know. I felt like there was maybe a point at the script level where it was about something, whether it was a show business satire or a, you know, father struggling with his daughter, or a father or an actor trying to find work. Like, there are all these different things, and then it doesn't ever necessarily amount to any of them.
No, there's just like no story here with like a beginning, middle, and end. And like,
but so, there's like the beginning and middle of like three stories.
Yeah. And I'm watching the movie and I'm like, there's something missing from this movie. But you know what is not missing from this movie is for the characters to sing.
Yeah, there's no place. We kept going like, wait. Well, there was one scene on the airplane where I was like, I think a song could have fit here. Because they had like a lot of weird moments where like characters were moving their heads in unison, like as if they're about to start singing. And then there were a couple notes in the score where like it felt like it was building to a song.
Yes. But
then no song came.
But I'm wondering if that was just us watching the movie knowing it was originally a
musical.
That's
what I was thinking too.
Because, yeah, it's just... Imagine like if you were watching The Sound of Music and they cut out all the songs. That would be a weird movie, right? Because it's made like a musical.
I would say it's more like, imagine if you're watching Bye Bye Love and then someone told you there were 10 songs in an alternate cut. It's because the movie doesn't feel like it ever had songs in it or ever would have songs in it.
Because, no.
Which is probably a testament to James L. Brooks' editing, that he could edit a musical into something that doesn't feel anything like a musical.
I know. Shouldn't this have won the Oscar for Best Editing in 1994?
I think so.
And they just gave it to, like, a drugged out, hungry James L. Brooks. Like, he comes. I just imagine him, like, in the basement of, like, this seedy motel, just cutting footage. Just crazed, hasn't eaten or slept for days.
And you brought it up at the end. There are only three credited songs at the end of the credits. It's as if he cut out all music. Even, like, there were scenes where he's listening to the radio, and James R. Brooks was like, Prince won't be in my movie, then no fucking music will be in my movie.
Because I didn't notice that until the end, but yeah, like, every movie has songs in it. Like, someone pulls up in a car, and they're listening to the radio.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie has... no songs. It's like this movie exists in a universe where music doesn't exist. But it was originally a musical.
But that's what I think it was like. James L. Brooks, out of spite, was like, I hate music now, so fuck it. It doesn't belong in this movie.
Like, it's the weirdest fucking movie to watch, just because you were watching it on that level of like, how the fuck was this a musical at one point? I don't believe that it ever was. But apparently it was. And I would imagine if we watched the musical version of it, I would be equally as confused.
I would be like, why the fuck are they singing in this otherwise, like, sort of...
Right.
What is it, a dramedy, I guess? Because it's not particularly funny at any point.
No. It's funny in that way that they're commenting on the industry itself. You know, but I don't think... You didn't think of it as a comedy like that. Well, I think when Albert Brooks is giving his monologue like, I don't make movies for people who drink cappuccinos. I make movies with explosions and I want it louder and louder. I don't care about the art. Supposed to be a funny... That's a funny commentary on Hollywood.
Is it because,
right?
He says, I make popcorn movies. I make movies for the masses. It's a populist sentiment, but I don't think you're meant to get from that he's bad at what he does. Yeah, like some of the executives that work under him, you're like, oh, they have a really shallow approach to what should be an artistic enterprise. But with James O. Brooks, I do kind of get the sense that he cares about making movies. He just doesn't care about making Oscar bait movies. You know, he okay. cares about making movies that test
Wait,
well.
You said James L. Brooks. Albert Brooks.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do that a lot yeah. during this podcast.
Albert Brooks' character is a shallow Hollywood producer.
Albert Brooks, yes. James L. Brooks is not in the movie. He just wrote and directed it. Albert Brooks is the movie producer.
Yeah.
And I don't get him as not, necessarily...
He's not the producer of I'll Do Anything. He's the producer of the movie within a movie.
He's... Which, by the way, they show clips of the movie within a movie where Woody Harrelson beats a man to death with a piece of pork after a giant hook flings at somebody. I want to see that fucking movie more than this goddamn
movie. Doesn't that movie look great?
It does!
And then that movie tests poorly!
But, and also, I think that is one moment where I think you're right. They're trying to say this is what a bad movie is.
Right.
But no, I fucking want to see that movie.
Well, and then people... That's what I also don't understand about the movie is because... Albert Brooks goes to that screening of like a dumb Hollywood action movie, you know, like the movies that we shouldn't even be making. But the audience loves it. They're hooting and hollering. They're loving it. And then Albert Brooks gets the notes and he's like, they didn't like it.
No, it was a weird kind of thing. The scores were high, but they weren't high in the demos, I think. Or they weren't, there was no, like, the level of excitement was off. So it was like, oh yeah, they like this movie, but it seems like people aren't ready for action movies now.
Oh, so they liked seeing the movie, but they wouldn't go pay and see it, I guess. Okay.
Because he says that, like, oh wow, a score's this high, it's still, you know, whatever. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was like a weird sort of, like, half good result.
Okay, well I guess that, because he's so depressed that, yeah, I guess that people love the movie. So if he released that movie just as is... Wouldn't people go see, like, someone would see the movie, really like it, just like that test audience did, tell their buddy that it was really good.
Well, I don't know about test audiences so much. Like we have weird experiences where, when we write our movies, like, with notes. And the notes seem incredibly arbitrary, but the producers and stuff just trust them implicitly. They're like, this guy says this thing about this movie, it must be true, right. Fix it. And it's like, that's where there's weird shit like that. And I think you get that a little bit later on where he's like, would you fuck him? Like they're trying to cast his part. And it's like, would you go to bed with this guy? You know, like, those are the kind of arbitrary considerations that are made, you know. And yeah, it can be maddening and frustrating sometimes when you're actually working within it and trying to make something good.
Is it possible to make a movie about making a movie without seeming like you're up your own ass pretentious?
Well, fucking, I don't think James L. Brooks could do it, because so many lines in this movie are James L. Brooks complimenting his own lines, where one character tells another character, like, hey, that's a really clever thing you just said.
Right, and that's so weird to think that, like, why can't we just watch this movie just like, oh, maybe Nick Nolte's character really liked what Albert Brooks's character said. But no, we're watching it on another level of James Brooks, because he's the writer and director, if he writes a character that says a funny line, and then he writes, and then the next character laughs at the funny line I just wrote.
And the thing is, and every character in this movie has at least one moment, many of them have several, that are like incredibly written moments. Like they're monologues that no living real person would ever give in real life as erudite or as clever as they sound. And it's like they have their big sort of movie moment. Like, they have a whole character who says that she had this weird reaction to pills that means she's constantly... Now she can't tell lies. She's honest, infallibly.
Yeah.
That's not a real person. But she's just there so that she can tell you the thing that rocks you to your core in a way that only people in movies say things.
I know. It's just so weird because this movie's about making a movie. But this movie is just so Hollywood sometimes, and so overly written and manufactured, but it's kind of rallying against itself, right?
Well, like, the apotheosis of what we're talking about, there's a scene where Nick Nolte challenges one of these dumb executives about, like, how he's dumb and he's not doing it right, and he's sort of cheapening the art. But the speech he's giving is such a rousing, cliche thing that you would, if you see it in a movie, you're like, oh, fuck, really? You're going to give that speech? That's so not naturalistic.
Oh, my God, yeah, that perfectly encapsulates it. A character in your movie is saying, oh, people don't like art, and everything's phony, the movies are fake, but I'm going to write a movie that's totally fake and does everything I hate movies do.
Yes, it's so fucking weird. And also, there are so many actors in this movie that I guess weren't famous at the time. Like Anne Heche, Gary Busey, Ian McKellen.
Jake Busey.
No,
Rosie O'Donnell.
Rosie O'Donnell. Well, I guess this was the same year as Exit to Eden, so she was somewhat known. But But yeah, just so many actors were like, is that fucking Anne Heche for like 2 seconds? Or the redhead from News Radio?
Yeah, Jolie Fisher and Vicki Lewis. So I guess, yeah, it's a testament to James Earl Brooks. He's got an eye for talent because his cast of nobodies went on to be...
We know he's a good writer. At least he has a good sense of powerful moments. A lot of the classic moments on The Simpsons that you think of as like heartfelt, they always say come from James L. Brooks.
Oh yeah, I mean he's great.
Like the I am Lisa Simpson moment from The Substitute Teacher, when that was a James L. Brooks moment.
Yeah, he, you know, well, because I think that's why The Simpsons was so good early on, is because James L. Brooks really, I think, emphasized the heart of the characters.
Yeah, he insisted on them being real people. Even if they're cartoons.
Yeah, if you watch like the director's commentaries of The Simpsons, you'll hear a lot of people saying that about James L. Brooks and how like you needed the gags there, but you also needed the soul there too.
Well, and he also wrote The Graduate, didn't he?
No, that was Buck Henry.
Oh, was it Buck Henry? Was it The Graduate? What did he write then?
Did Terms of Endearment, As Good as It Gets, Broadcast News.
I was thinking of something. I thought it was The Graduate. Maybe not.
No.
Well, anyway, but I mean, it's weird that you see that sort of translated to this movie where it just feels like schmaltz. There's no core to it in the way that The Simpsons has that core.
Yeah, well, maybe because this is all heart and schmaltz and no laughs. Like, The Simpsons also had good gags,
too. Do you think if it had maybe a more biting edge to it, that the schmaltz would have been better or worked better?
Maybe. I don't know.
If they undercut a few of them with, you know, more sort of gritty realism. Not gritty realism, but like sort of, you know, if James L. Brooks maybe like leveled with him and like, you know, yeah, you gave that fucking speech, but here's the reality. Fuck you.
Yeah. Or if there was more like absurd parodies where it went just like a little bit over the top. Because, the movie they're watching is Woody Harrelson throws a fish hook at a guy and then grabs a big thing of meat. Beats the guy with a big slab of meat, like, repeatedly.
Yes.
And then goes, sorry to bust your chops. Like, that's a parody of a movie.
But it's also a movie I would fucking write, and a movie I would fucking
watch. Absolutely. But, like, James Earl Brooks is like, this is the silly part of Hollywood. These are the movies we shouldn't make.
But you shouldn't make I'll Do Anything either.
Right. But yeah, if there was more, more kind of Hollywood parodies like that. And I think there was enough with Albert Brooks. Albert Brooks' character is basically just... vapid and... But,
well, that's the thing. I don't think he is. I think he's a realist.
Like, he doesn't like the art house shit, you know?
Well, like when people talk about hating Michael Bay, and then they go, why are these movies so successful? Because Americans love it. Because he gives America what they want. I don't hate Michael Bay. I didn't like the last Transformers movie. I liked the one before it. And I liked fucking Armageddon.
Yeah.
I like Bad Boys. I like The Rock. I like fucking shitty B-movie action movies that he does. I think he's a great director who just often does... He just often goes over the top so much, and then we hate ourselves for liking the kind of movies he makes.
It's hard to hate someone who liked that, because... Yeah, like the Albert Brooks character in this movie. He doesn't care if the movies are good, just as long as they make money. And if you were in the business of making movies... That's what you would want to do. So when people complain like, oh, why is everything a fucking remake? Or why aren't there any original ideas in Hollywood? Because the movies that have original ideas don't make as much money as
big, loud, noisy action. Because America doesn't want them.
Right. So why would a studio want to make better and better art? They wouldn't want to throw this same shit that you're buying down your throat because they know you're buying that. It's the same reason McDonald's doesn't go, hey, we should make, like, filet mignon, you know? Like, we should class up our stores a little bit. No, you're addicted to this fucking dollar fast food, so we're going to keep shoving this down your throat.
Yeah, but again, I don't know that the movie is even, at least not wholeheartedly criticizing that. It is, and then it isn't.
Right. Because those guys don't, like, lose at the end or anything. No one learns a lesson of, like, oh, this isn't what you were supposed to do. No one even questions that that's not what you're supposed to do.
Well, because let's get into the Mr. Deeds thing. Because we had kind of an argument as we were watching this as to whether or not this was meant to be ironic or whether or not it was meant to be sincere. I think it was meant to be sincere. I think you thought it was meant to be ironic.
I think so, yeah.
Because basically, at one point... the Jolie Richardson character admits that she doesn't know anything about action movies. Jolie Richardson's character, she's the actress, you probably know her from Nip Tuck. She was the wife on that show.
Yeah, and she's like the assistant to James L. Brooks.
Yeah.
And her whole character is, she's been reading scripts.
Yeah, she's scoring them and everything.
She's supposed to give a little rating of like, oh, we should make this movie. Oh, we should definitely pass on this movie. And she's had this one script that she has never given to her boss because her boss would never want to make it.
No, she did say good. She said she sent it to him and he ignored it.
Right, because it's too good.
Yeah.
It's the movie they should be making rather than the movies they are making. They're making Transformers, but they should be making Call Me By Your Name, you know? Like, this is the movie we should strive to create something this good.
And she gives this big impassioned speech about this script that she has, and it's the greatest thing I've ever read, and if you make it, it'll work. I know it. I'll bet my life on it. And all this stuff, and it's like this, like, it's the moment in, like, Jerry Maguire when you're convinced, you know. But, and then he's like, okay, what is it? Oh, it's Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. And he goes, a remake. I like it. But, and I get why you think that that's a joke about how she's a dumbass who's unoriginal, but the way the movie does it, I feel like the movie doesn't understand that.
Oh, no, I guess I give James L. Brooks way more credit than you do, because I know James L. Brooks is writing that to be a joke. That's the punchline, is she's giving this impassioned speech of like, we need to be more creative than this. We're drowning in our just giving junk food to the masses. We need to create something better. Like a remake of Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. Like, that's the best she can come up with. Well, that's the joke.
But then later on in the movie, she's like, yeah, I know it's a remake, but what ideas are original? And it's a great rewrite of the movie. And then everybody that reads it is like, yeah, this is really good. But not in a way where it's like, oh, we're all dumb. It's like, no, this is what should be made. You know, I mean,
so we should be making remakes.
Plus, it's also, I think this was made before the idea of the remake became such a
thing.
That
is true. This is 1994. We weren't into
remake fatigue.
Yeah, we were just getting into, they were turning every TV show into a movie. Every movie had a sequel. Yeah, movies didn't really have sequels until Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and then they were rare.
Well, then you had like The Godfather. And then, you know, well, more The Godfather 3. And then I think then after that, it was sort of like every movie gets a sequel. Like after the 90s.
Yeah. It was around this time when, you know, it was just, okay. I think Terminator 2 was a game changer.
We weren't like complaining about it. We weren't like, oh my God, another sequel.
No, we kind of liked it. Yeah. Lethal Weapon 2. Yeah. But now it's just like, oh my God. Every summer, I'm like, what's this? I didn't even know that there was a first one of this.
At the same time, though, I'm of the mind that the greatest movies being made today are the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies.
Oh, I agree with that.
And they're all sequels and fucking shit. That's true. Like, I can't complain about that.
That's true. But, like, yeah, last summer I was like, fucking Pirates of the Caribbean 6? What? Did I see 3
5,
or 4?
It was 5.
No, because,
but
like,
I believe they are making 6.
It's just there's so many sequels, I forget the first thing now. It's just, it's weird to,
yeah,
weird to figure it out. But like, I see so many sequels that I can't keep track of them anymore. Because like, Fast and Furious 7 comes out, and I'm like, wait, I have to remember what happened in Captain America 1 first, because I'm seeing that next week.
Well, I'm
and then I have to watch 6 Fast and Furious
movies.
When
they had Now You See Me, and then they had Now You See Me 2, but not Now You Don't.
Oh. Doesn't Now You See Me 2 sound like a British lady playing a trick with her poo?
Oh, like Now You See Me number 2?
Now You See Me 2!
No, when you say trick, is it like, you know that game where you put your hand like under your balls or something, and then if they look, they punch you? It's like, if you see me too, then I can punch you in the face.
I was thinking like, she took a secret poo like right behind your chair or something, and you weren't supposed to know it was there, but then you turn around and you see it, and she's like, Now You See Me Too!
Wouldn't you smell it? Wouldn't that tip you off?
That's her joke. That's what she likes to do. It's like,
is this Dame Edna? Who is this doing this?
I think she had like a subpar, or like a, she had a part on Betty White's Off Your Rockers. Like, they would cut to her.
No, you know what? The only way this works for me is if it's the queen.
The old lady who plays tricks with her poo to people.
Did you see the BFG, the most recent remake?
No.
Oh, there's an extended sequence in that movie where they eat this food that makes you fart. And like fart like green puffs of like smoke. Uh-huh. And they, we're going to have an audience with the queen. Oh, and he brought his delicacy along. And it's all just
fart.
The queen and her porgies farting. And it's like, that's what I want this ridiculous game to be.
All right, we're back to I'll Do Anything.
Yeah, that was a subplot in this movie, but they cut it at the last minute.
There was an old lady just throwing her shit everywhere.
But isn't that weird, too, that a significant part of this plot was about test screenings going poorly and ruining a movie, and then test screenings...
Oh, yeah! What the fuck, man?
Poorly and ruin the movie?
It's like the most fucking meta movie. When they're filming a studio set, and I'm sure there was a production designer just going like, ugh, this studio set doesn't look like a studio set enough, even though it's an actual studio set. Put some dressing over here so it looks more like a set.
Why does he have to be gay? I feel like that's not you.
I guess not all production designers are gay, but I'm pretty sure the majority are, so I don't feel homophobic in doing that production designer voice. And also, that wasn't a gay voice. That was my Italian voice. I was trying to be an Italian guy. This spaghetti isn't cold enough.
But that's the thing. You would expect that with cutting out all the music, that the performances would be more broad than they are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, like, there are brief glimpses where they seem to be, but for the majority of the movie, it feels like a straight drama.
Yeah. It's insane. My mind would be blown if I saw the rough cut of this. And I'm sure that those test audiences were like, wait a minute. Why is Nick Nolte singing and dancing right now after he picked up his daughter? Okay, we need to get into this fucking daughter. Because this is
I liked the performance of the daughter.
Oh, no, the daughter was fine. I'm just talking about the how he gets his daughter.
Okay. Because
this makes no fucking sense.
Well, it only makes sense, again, if you're following the conception of the Tracy Ullman character, the mom, that she's just fucking batshit crazy. Okay. Which the movie essentially supports that.
But then they never bring her back. Once he has the kid, the mother is out of the picture.
I was waiting for them, like her to come back and go, like, because we said she's arrested and taken by the marshals. But I was waiting for her to go, like, oh, yeah, they dropped the case or something, and now I'm back and I want my kid back.
Right. You would think that it was leading to a custody battle just because it's a movie and that's in every movie with a single dad and his daughter.
Well, and because it's right after he's learned to love her, and she even says at one point, like, she had to cry on cue, and she's like, I thought about somebody taking me away from you.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, that should have happened earlier in the movie, and then Tracy Ullman comes in.
And, right. And then she wants the kid back, and like, oh, well, no, you can't see Nick Nolte anymore, and Nick Nolte's like, oh, but I'm her father.
And again, this is sort of like the head of state conversation, right. Where it's like, why aren't we seeing the shitty cliches that we see in every movie?
It's true. I guess if we saw that, we'd be like, ugh, God.
I feel like so much of this is just structure stuff that is ingrained in our brains now, that when we don't see it, we're like, why didn't they do that thing?
Well, but not even a mention of her, though.
No.
Once Tracy Ullman is out of the movie, her character just disappears.
You'd think
she's
daughter.
The mother of the girl.
And their relationship is so close to the point of almost creepy.
Yeah.
To the point where you think she would at some point mention, like, oh, I miss my mom.
Yeah. No, never. Once she lives with Nick Nolte, she's like, Mom? Never heard of her.
Yeah.
Like, they never talk about her again. But they make such a big deal about Mom just being, like, so overprotective. Because...
Well, she even says, remember the rules. Nobody loves you like I do.
Right.
And later on in the movie, she says, I think either she says she doesn't, she loves him more than anybody, or he says I know the same line or something.
Right. Because, yeah. But, yeah, it's almost like she's indoctrinating these things like a fucking cult master, you know? Like,
yeah.
You will love your mother and only your mother. Don't trust anyone that's not your mother. She says, like, don't take candy from strangers because they might be monsters or something. I can't remember.
No, don't talk to strangers because they might be monsters.
Yeah, because they're going to be monsters who eat you and, like, destroy you.
Well, then,
like,
and then...
don't say that to a fucking
always brush your teeth after you eat or your gums will bleed and melt out of your face or something.
Right, she's a horrible fucking mother.
Yeah.
And then to never bring that fucking back up.
That's the point. I don't think that's, like, us reading into that.
Oh, man. But, like, just to have her be that horrible of a fucking mom, and then never to bring up, like, the kids going, like, oh, well, this is how Mom used to do it. And
well, I was expecting, like, her to have all these weird rules in her head about how to behave from her mom, and him having to, like, kind of teach her, like, no, that's not how you're supposed to act.
Right. Because that's how movies work. Movies have, like, setups and payoffs and conflict. This movie just kind of rolls along to the next fucking thing. But this is the thing that confuses me. He knew that he was taking his daughter for 3 weeks. He's like, oh, I'm trying to be a working actor. I'm auditioning in Hollywood. It's not going too well. And I'm divorced. My mother or my ex-wife has the kid. I'm going to have her for the next 3 weeks, though. He goes to pick the kid up from Tracy Allman. And Tracy Allman's like, it's not going to be 3 weeks. I'm going to jail for 5 to 10 years. What, nobody fucking told you that shit?
Well, the federal marshal even says, you haven't told him?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, apparently not. And, well, you've mentioned it. You brought this up, too. When he does get the kid, he seems like he didn't even prepare for the 3 weeks.
Right. It's the first day he has the kid, and he's like, oh, God damn it, I don't know how to take care of this kid. I'm going to drop her off at the neighbor's house. Bro, were you just going to do that anyway? Because this is the first day, originally, you knew you were going to have the fucking kid in your house.
Which, and that neighbor lady, because that's the other weird thing about this movie, as we were watching it, we weren't sure, like, clearly the movie was trying to set Nick Nolte's character up romantically with one of at least, like, four women in the movie, but we weren't sure which until, like, an hour in.
Well, yeah, every single woman he meets, he has, like, a meet-cute with.
And then mostly it's just process of elimination when you finally figure it out. Well, no, she's with Albert Brooks, so it can't be her.
Right, because...
The babysitter disappeared, so it can't be her.
I guess it's Julie Richardson that he's going to have sex with eventually.
And then at the end, it's almost as if they're not going to get together, like, she's... like, pressuring him or something, and...
Right, do they get together at the end?
I don't know if they do or not.
Not officially.
And I think it's almost like they break up at the end, but not really.
Right. Maybe there
was... It's almost as if this movie was cobbled together from a loose end, and it was a completely different movie beforehand.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, there are scenes missing in this movie that give you so much, like, information I need to follow the story. But I can't imagine that information being fucking sung to me, so...
That's the thing, what? Yeah, the connective tissue...
Is not song!
Is not song. Especially not Prince! It's not fucking Prince and Carol...
Yeah, he's gonna fucking sing a Prince ballad. He picks his kids making a noise on the airplane. He's like, ah, I'm a frazzled little guy, you sexy motherfucker. What the fuck?
I know there had to be a musical sequence in that scene. Because the moment she... She's, like, crying and complaining. She wants her yellow dress, and it's in the hold. And so she slaps herself in the face, and then everybody in front of them turn around in unison, like, don't hit her. Like,
don't hit your kid in unison. Yeah, that's a very, like, fucking music
man. That's
the
introduction,
you know,
to a musical number.
Right.
That never comes. But that's, I think, that's the only one I really noticed.
That's the only real...
Well, I was also thinking when Albert Brooks was glad-handing in the restaurant, maybe that was going to be a thing.
Oh, like he's gonna have a song where like
I'm the man about town or something. Yeah,
I grease the palms in hot. What the? I gotta see these songs now.
They don't exist.
God damn it.
Well, I guess they were filmed, but I don't think they're on the DVD. Yeah, I don't think I know the music is in fucking Prince's vault.
Yeah, and then I guess James Earl Brooks says he wants to make a director's cut with all the songs back in, but the music rights clearing them would be like astronomical.
I don't know why he doesn't just release it as a bootleg.
Well, you think James Earl Brooks knows how to fucking...
I don't think he... But
put
I,
his shit on... He'd be pulling up Napster.
Well, he just edits it together and says, hey, my grandson that knows about the internets.
Fuck it. Yeah, man. You know? Why not? Yeah, why not if you're not going to make any money off of it anyway?
It's not like people are clamoring for that cut of I'll Do Anything. Like it's fucking the director's cut of Blade Runner or some shit.
Why spend this money on something no one has even heard that they might want? It's so fucking
This movie
weird.
Is everything and nothing all at once.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, we get plane hijinks where... this, like you said, this song seemed like it was a musical scene. Because also, you like, the little girl, she's like, I want my yellow dress. He's like, oh, it's... It's in the storage bin. You can't have it. She's like, I want it. And I'm going to scream. Ah! And then, like, the flight attendant, like, comically drops his coffee. Yeah. Like, what? Like, just the thought of this girl not getting what she wants makes the whole plane go, like, whoa!
See, but and that's the... Oh, fuck. We're getting my favorite line in the movie. When, what's her name? The actress?
Julie Kavner.
That's Julie Kavner?
Who I've always enjoyed.
Of Simpsons fame?
Yep, Marge Simpson
so
herself.
So how many Simpsons actors do we have in this? We have Harry Shearer, Julie Kavner.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, there's no Castellaneta, Cartwright, or Smith, or Azaria. But, yeah, Harry Shearer is in, like, two scenes.
But no, Julie Kavner, she's the girl that we mentioned that's, like, clinically honest. And she's, I guess, another... She's the person that does the test screenings for Albert Brooks.
Yes.
And they start dating. You never really see them start dating. Maybe that was happened in a musical number that we missed.
Well, that's another one because when she's on the phone with, like, her girlfriend, it's your favorite line coming up, and she goes, yes, oh, I'm still seeing that man. I thought she was talking about Nick Nolte because they had like two meet cutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, are they together now? Like, I know like in movie terms that we're going that way, but I guess we weren't going that way because she's talking about Albert Brooks.
Yeah. But no, but just to get to my favorite line, she's talking to her girlfriend about this man, and she said, what is it exactly? Did you write it down?
Oh, no, I didn't write it down, but she says something along the lines of,
I'm glad I can feel my legs wobbly again.
Yeah, it's nice to have my legs wobbling
again. It's great that Albert Brooks gave me a good fucking that I haven't had in a while. Signed, Julie Kavner.
I know, human beings don't talk like that. And that's not the first thing you leap to. Like, oh, hey, you seeing someone? Oh, yeah, I got a girlfriend. Yeah, it's good to be fucked on a nightly basis.
And it's like, you hear that line, and she's like, a man wrote that line.
Yeah.
A man wrote that and went, that's good. That's like, I'm done for the night. I don't need to do anything else because that line is in this script.
Oh, yeah, I got a boyfriend. He's nice. And, oh, yeah. Oh, my knees wobble all the time now.
He fucked me right. Cutting print money.
I think that's all I have to say about it.
Yeah, really. You didn't even refer to your notes because it was so fucking crazy.
No, and all my notes are basically just like, what's going on here? What's going on here with all the meta shit?
Well, yeah, but there's even weird stuff like we talked about the babysitter, she who just sort of disappears halfway through, but like, you expect, like, he gives the girl to the babysitter, she's like a girl that lives across the hall who has kids. And he's like, I saw you with kids. Maybe you'll like to watch my kid. And she's like, I guess. And then when they come back, she's like, oh, no. He hears, like, crying. And he thinks, oh, my kid's being a terror. Then he goes there, and it's like, oh, no, can she stay a little bit more? My kid cries, but not when my kid is with your kid.
Right. So Nick Nolte's daughter is not the one crying. She's actually doing an exemplary job at this nursery.
Yeah. Which, like, is a character turn, because up to this point, she's been a little brat. But you're like, oh, she has this weird, like, kid whisperer thing, or she's more complicated as a character than you think. But then after that, that doesn't stick. She's still just the same bratty kid.
Yeah.
And they never reference that again. Like, why was that a thing?
Well, it's just like, movies need complications. Like,
but they also need the complications to make sense and be organic to the story.
Right. You're setting up something like, oh, I'm going to drop my kid off with this neighbor. When you're writing a script, that should amount to something, right? But it doesn't. The next scene is, he hears the scream and he goes, oh no, my kid must not be doing too good. Oh, she's doing good? Everything's fine? Okay. But then, so why did we drop them off in the first place?
Well, I think...
If it's just going to be, we're going to set this up, but nothing's going
to
happen.
I think the whole idea behind that was just to justify the fact that, like, I want to tell this parallel story of him as an out-of-work actor trying to find work, and him as a single dad. Okay, what are we going to do when he's working? Like, he can't have the kid with him.
Oh.
So I guess we're going to establish that he has this easy out.
Okay.
Where the kids watch during the day.
So that wasn't a setup for complications. That was just...
No, but it's structured as a setup for complications.
Yes.
It's written as if it would be, but then it's not.
But no.
Everything in this movie is like, it's written as if it would lead to this, and then it doesn't. But it doesn't lead to anything more interesting. It's not like it pivots.
Okay.
It just peters out.
So you think he set up the fact that she does well at this nursery so he can justify the fact that he can be off all the time, even
yes.
though he has a kid at home.
And we wouldn't question it and go, what the fuck? Why are you not watching
right.
my kid?
You would never go like, wait a minute, why are you romancing Julie Richardson? Don't you have a fucking kid at home? Oh, he probably left it with the neighbor who is, everything
yeah.
is happy there. Okay, well then that's just shitty.
Well, but I can't think of any other reason for it then, because again, it doesn't amount to anything in the
right.
actual movie.
And that's just shitty to bring that up and just do nothing with it. And, like, maybe I'm watching the movie wrong, though. Maybe I wasn't supposed to see
well,
that as, like, a
I do think we are. We found the line of you giving him the benefit of the doubt, me being more cynical. But then again, we both watched the same movie, and it was shitty.
Yeah.
So I feel like my cynicism is more borne out.
But at the same time, I didn't think it was shitty. I wouldn't, like, not recommend it.
Well, I forget one of the three movies, Nick Nolte and his kid, I feel like that was good. But the movie satire didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And the Albert Brooks, Julie Kavner shit didn't work really for me.
No. There's boring parts of the movie, but the movie as a whole, I thought, had a certain kind of charm to it. And I just think that's James L. Brooks. It has a way with tone, you know? He has a way with working with actors where they seem just charming. And these actors are also charming, too. So, I mean, I think
that's also reminding you, I think, a little bit of Three Fugitives, a movie we both love. You know, Nick Nolte and a little girl.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, because I think Nick Nolte's actually a good actor when he's playing sweet. sometimes well, when he leans too into like the gruff thing. I mean, I like him as a gruff guy.
Well, it's hard because
I also like him as a sweet guy.
His baseline is so gruff.
Yeah.
That I think when he tries to tone that down and be a little sweeter, I think it works. Whereas if he gruffs it up, it's like that's too gruff.
Right. Well, it's just his voice too. I mean, it's hard. Nick Nolte has such like a raspy voice that even when he's saying sweet things, it's almost like I think Nick Nolte might want to murder this.
But it's almost like it's like John Wayne in The Quiet Man. You know, it's like we know him as this rough and tumble Western guy, but then you see him in like this romance, and then it works because it's like you know the hard edge is being softened. You know, I think that's why it works.
Right. It's better because Nick Nolte has a gruff personality that it's nice to see him in a.
I just wish he'd just been. An unemployed guy and not an unemployed actor, and we just cut all the showbiz bullshit.
Or leaned it into the showbiz bullshit. Because like well, I said, it's two movies. Yeah. It's two movies.
But I would have liked the him and his kid thing better, I think.
Yeah. I think...
Like, if this is... What's the Martin Short movie where he has the kid that shows up on his doorstep?
Simple Wish? What? Oh, Steve Martin?
Oh, Steve Martin, not Martin. Yeah.
Man, no, you're just getting names all kinds of wrong this podcast.
And you're the one that got high before, not me.
At least I can keep my Brookses and my Martins straight.
But no, the Steve Martin movie, Simple Twist of Fate, something like that. Or even like Curly Sue. I've never seen it, but you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But it's just weird to see Nick Nolte go like, I love you, and no one's ever going to take you away from me.
But again, but then that does work when you get the sadder moments when, you know, he actually has to break down, you know?
Right, but what is he ever sad about?
Well, he's just sad. Like, he can't get through to this girl. He can't get through to this daughter, and you know, he just worries about her, and she keeps getting into situations that he worries about. You know, it's just you know, it's making his heart swell up.
Because then to describe, so that's the setup. Now he's a single dad because the mom's over in jail, and then I guess the rest of the plot of the movie is he's trying to get a part in a movie, but he's not testing well. Even the girl he's having sex with says she wouldn't fuck him in the...
Well, and that's the other thing I wanted to ask. Was that her not wanting to admit that she did, in fact, go to bed with him?
I think so.
Because at the same time, when you saw... Because you see that... You actually see them have sex. It's not like a, you know, Skinamax moment or anything. But it's actually kind of a comedic moment.
It's not a hard... Yeah, there's not a hardcore fuck scene in I'll Do Anything.
Well, I just meant to say it's not like romantic or sensual or like erotic. It's actually kind of played for comedy. And the looks on her face, I wasn't sure if the movie was saying, because like she was getting all these phone calls. I didn't know if that meant like it was awkward because she kept getting phone calls, or it was awkward because he was bad in bed. And then later on, she couldn't, like she's like, we know she went to bed with him, but she wouldn't again because he's bad in bed.
Oh, wow. You're reading that scene completely different from me.
Well, I could go either way on it. I wasn't sure.
Oh, no, I thought, because they're in the focus group with Albert Brooks going like, what do you think of Nick Nolte as Mr. Deeds? And then he's asking them questions, and finally he's like, is he sexy? And they're like, oh yeah, he's sexy. And
that's
like,
the standard they use for everyone is, would you go to bed with him?
Right, but basically he's not like, I don't care if he's cute, I don't think if you think he's handsome. I want to know, would you fuck this guy? Because if you want to fuck him, you'll buy a ticket to see him in a movie. And then I think everyone else goes like, yeah, no. She, I think, really thinks that. You know, she does think, but she doesn't want to stand up for him by herself. She doesn't want to be the only person to stand up and go like, yeah, no, we should hire him and go against the group.
See, and this is another area where I think if the satire had been more obvious, or, I mean, the fact that it's not, like, I'm arguing that it's not as ironic as you think it is, you'd think somebody would mention, like, this is Mr. Deeds. Mr. Deeds isn't a sex symbol.
Right.
The fuckability of Mr. Deeds is not an issue here. You know,
you need that other person at the table to be the sane person in an insane world. Because everything.
Nobody ever says that in this movie.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that maybe that's not a commentary, even though you'd think it would be.
Yeah, and it's so weird to watch again. Like we said this with Head of State last week too. Watching this movie, which is a fictional story. In set kind of in the real universe, because they name check all these actors, there's a scene where two of the studio executives are like playing a game, and they're like, oh, James Spader, oh yeah, he's Weasley and Nosy, and they're like pointing out flaws of the actors, but then like they could just as easily say like Nick Nolte, because Nick Nolte exists in this universe.
Presumably.
Right, there would be Nick Nolte movies too.
Well, I don't know. Or is this the one? Is this the parallel universe where Nick Nolte was replaced by this guy?
Well, like, if they name-checked Eddie Murphy and they were like, oh, what about Eddie Murphy? Could they reference 48 Hours? Or would that be like, people would go like...
So yeah, what about the other guy in 48 Hours? I wanted that to be a line where, yeah, he's like, yeah, what was the other guy's name? I don't remember, you know? Like,
yeah, why not? Why not name-check Nick Nolte if you're going to, you know, and make your movie as meta as possible?
Well, what was the movie's obsession with Raul Julia? Because they mention Kiss of the Spider-Woman and he's up for the Raul Julia part. And then they mention him again in this, like, oh, Raul Julia and his bug eyes.
That is so mean, too.
But it's like, why... There are many movies that have no references to Raul Julia in them. This movie has two.
I can't remember exactly all the insults, but they're going over these, like, these actors, and then they're just picking a flaw about them. If Raul Julia's big weird bug eyes. Can you imagine if you were Raul Julia? You sat and watched this movie, and you're like, does James L. Brooks have a fucking problem with me? Like,
I think that's what killed him.
Why is he... I think he died in, like, 1994, too. The same year this movie came out.
Street Fighter was the last movie.
1994.
Wow. Then, yeah.
I believe...
Because he had cancer, I believe, during that movie.
Yeah, he died before that movie came out. So he must have died in 94 or 93. And, yeah, so this movie comes out after...
And I'm going to say it. Death. Street Fighter, great Raul Julia performance.
Oh, he's fabulous pretty much in everything.
But he makes that a watchable movie.
Oh, no, that guy was incredible. Yeah, I love Raul Julia. But that was also weird at the very beginning of the movie. He's like, okay, he's fresh off his Emmy win, and he's like, oh, and I know my agent's going to get me that part in Kiss of the Spider-Woman. It's between me and Raul Julia. If you've seen Kiss of the Spider-Woman, it's pretty very important to the story that Raul Julia's character is of a certain ethnicity.
That Nick Nolte is not.
Because he's in, like, a Brazilian prison, I believe. And yes, he's, like, one of the revolutionaries of that country. So I couldn't imagine Nick Nolte in the Raul Julia part. But they could have just as easily said, it's up against me and William Hurt, who's the white guy in the movie. Yeah. Like, wouldn't that be the role that Nick Nolte's character would go out for in that movie?
That's the other thing, because obviously he didn't get that, because we know in the real history that Raul Julia got that part. So I think... We are left to assume, on a, like, a metatextual level, that the reason Nick Nolte can't get any work is because he's been wedged into this alternate reality where he never got any work because, like, he couldn't have gotten that part because we know Raul Julia did. He couldn't gotten Mr. Deeds because Adam Sandler got that part. It eventually got reworked in Turnaround as an Adam Sandler vehicle.
He keeps losing out on parts because he's a fictional character a real universe.
It's like they fired Eric Stoltz off of Back to the Future, and then they're like, what about this Nick Nolte guy? No, he doesn't work either. Marty McFly.
Michael J. Fox.
It's just, yeah, I think he's just doomed by fate. Like, there's some kind of working of destiny where it's like, nope, he can't interrupt the timeline by taking any of these parts away from these real-life people.
He can exist in this universe, but he can't do anything.
He would just be a perennial failure.
Right. He can't do anything to excel because that would disturb the timeline.
Yes, but his daughter can be on the weirdest fucking sitcom ever. Can we talk about that?
Oh, yeah. And that's and then that's the turn of this movie. Like, I guess that's the plot now.
You say the turn of the movie, it's the last 20 minutes of the movie.
I know, and nothing fucking happens in the movie. But then they're like, oh, let's find a little bit of stakes here. Nope. Okay, let's find a little bit of stakes here. Nope. Okay, maybe there's some stakes here. Nope. Okay, these will just be the stakes, just and because we've run out of shit.
She hasn't even auditioned for the TV show. She's like, somebody just saw this bratty little girl, but she's perfect. I put her in the room, and then she gets the audition. And I thought maybe that was going to be the thing, like he was going to start getting jealous because she was getting roles and he wasn't.
Yeah.
But that never comes up.
No. That's what I'm thinking. Like, we're watching this movie and nothing's fucking happening in it. But as we talk about it, we're like, oh, I thought what was going to happen was something, anything, please. Literally, could you do anything and I'll do anything?
And here's the weird thing, too, because, like, we talked about the movie they're doing is this unoriginal remake, Mr. Deeds. And my thinking, again, my cynical reading of that was not that they were trying to make an ironic comment on it. The reason they made it a remake is so that we would immediately understand what it was.
Right.
So the idea that he is up for the part of Mr. Deeds, that resonates with us. Like, oh, we know that that's a big deal. So, like, because if they just said, there's a script, it's called, you know, whatever, whatever, you know.
Yeah. Home on the Prairie.
Home on the Prairie, and they have to explain what Home on the Prairie is, right. And who's the important character in Home on the Prairie, and that he'd be right for it. Like, he didn't want to take that time, so he's like, Mr. Deeds. Oh, we know what Mr. Deeds is. Right. And we know who Deeds is. Oh, that's you.
His name's in the title. Yeah. So even if you're not familiar with Mr. Deeds, if he's Mr. Deeds and Mr. Deeds goes to town, you go, oh, that's the main character.
It's a narrative shorthand so that he doesn't have to do hard work to establish a fictional thing in a fictional universe.
Right, so he doesn't have to keep going like, ugh, I'm up for the part in the movie. You know, Harrison, the lead in Home on the Prairie, the guy who is the main character.
But then you find out what TV show the daughter has been cast in, which I don't think we ever get the name of it. But it's the weirdest fucking show I've ever...
One Lone Whitey? Is that what it's called?
I think it might be. I think it might be called I Love African Americans. She's cast, and the way they explain the part is she's the only white girl in an all-minority foster home. Which, I mean, I guess maybe it's a play on Different Strokes.
Maybe.
Like, it's sort of, I don't know, like a reverse race, Different Strokes, I guess.
Well, because, yeah, there were a lot of, that's weird because, you can think of...
Or Punky Brewster as well.
Yeah. But yeah, to call her the one white girl in an all minority school, that seems, way out of context or, out of line for 1994 TV. We didn't have shows with just one white person.
Well, I mean, you had, like, The Cosby Show, and then you had, like, a Different World. Like, you had, like, black shows on.
Right.
So...
But that would be the show would be more about the black person, right? This is... She's the only white person, but it seems like the show's all about her. Doesn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't... Well...
Does she seem like she's the star of the show?
We do establish that the producers, or at least the director, is kind of racist, because he's talking to the black actress, and he's like, I want you to be more, and she's like, oh, you want me to Jack K it, don't you? It's like... Well, you know, that'd be good.
Yeah. Like, he's doing everything he can not to say over-the-top black. And then she's like, you mean over-the-top black? And he's like, yes, exactly. Thank you for saying it so I didn't have to say it.
But no, but that's... And that's the thing. The audition... We see the audition. And fine, whatever. That's the premise of the show. And it's weird that they have to articulate it. But then the actual scene she's auditioning for... She's rocking in a chair, and I guess the black foster home lady is interviewing her, and like, you know, what do you have to say? Stop rocking on your rocking chair. What do you have to say? Right. And she's like, I like colored ladies.
Right.
And he's like, it's not colored, it's black. And then she's like, it's not black, it's African American, which is supposedly a laugh line, but it seemed like it wasn't.
Yeah, the audience hoots and howls over that.
But then she's like, that's her cue. And through the whole movie, or at least for the last 20 minutes, she's worried she's not going to be able to cry on cue. But she's like, oh, she gets to look at her dad in the audience, and she later reveals that she wasn't, she was thinking about her getting taken away from him. That's what led her be able to cry. But the line is, I love African Americans. And they're like all applaud. Like, this is the weirdest fucking pilot for a TV series ever.
And what's really weird about it is that the audience is laughing, but it's played like a drama. So, in another weird thing is how this movie doesn't seem like a musical but was. That seems like a drama, but the audience is laughing at it for some reason.
Well, you talk about James L. Brooks being a master of tone, but the movie is
now
so weirdly atonal.
There's so many sweet things about this, but yeah, on the other side, I don't know what the fuck he was going
for. He's not a master of tone. He's a master of character. You liked all the characters in this,
maybe
as
that
did I.
Was it.
And so that goes a long way for a movie like this. And so you realize after the fact, like, none of that shit made any sense, but I like the characters, so that's enough.
I know, and I'm wondering if I watch, like, Broadcast News, because now that I'm thinking of it, Broadcast News is a really good movie, but does anything really... I can't think of what the plot is. Maybe there's not a plot to it. Maybe
I don't remember it either.
Maybe I just like that movie because I like all those characters.
And honestly, Terms of Endearment, I mean, it has the big hook of the dying character.
Right.
But other than that, that's what it's all centered around. Other than that, it's just a lot of, you know...
Yeah, that movie's just...
spinning its wheels.
It's from birth to death of a character. But yeah, the rest of it, they don't really do anything. It's just the story of a life, really. But yeah, there's no real central plot.
But that's the thing. He's just very good at crafting... realistic characters, even if they don't speak like realistic people would.
Right. So I wonder if maybe I watched Terms of Endearment or Broadcast News closely, I would come away with it the same as this movie. Which this movie I didn't like, but I didn't hate.
No.
But I'm thinking that I really love Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News. Maybe I'm way off on those.
I've always been curious to see The Evening Star. I've never watched that.
I never watched that one either. That seems weird to take. And did James L. Brooks direct that?
I don't think he did.
I don't think he did. That doesn't seem like something he
would
do.
But that's, again, we're talking about sequels at a time when...
But then again, I never saw his last movie, too, which was supposed to be, like, abysmal. It was Jack Nicholson's, one of the Jack Nicholson's last ones, too. With Reese Witherspoon and Owen Wilson.
Oh, I don't think I saw this.
How Do You Know or something. Oh, it bombed horribly. I think it had Paul Rudd in it, too.
I've never heard of this.
And I have no idea what it's about, but it was supposed to be, like, terrible. It got, like, horrible reviews. And I was, like, the first one of James L. Brooks' movies that, like, critics and audience just, like, savaged.
Hmm.
Well, no, because he did Spanglish, too. Did people like that?
I think that had some critical acclaim, I think.
Yeah. And apparently this one did, too. It's up in the positive on Rotten Tomatoes.
And that's the other thing, too. He says, like, he loved the idea of doing a musical. He never did it again.
Yeah.
You'd think he would have tried again.
Maybe. Well, it's so weird that he... And to hear him talk about it, he conceived it as a musical. The music didn't work, but then he realized that the story was there without the songs. So why did you want to do a musical in the first place if you were just telling a story with songs in it?
Yeah, like Hamilton, I guess that's what nothing a musical but songs. Is.
Right. I don't know. Why would you want to do it? You feel like the musical... Well, in musicals, is music that important?
You know, now that I think about it, like, if you took all the songs out of West Side Story, I think it'd probably still work.
Yeah. I mean, except for the fact that they're dancing and stuff.
Yeah.
I guess that's the thing. In this movie, there would be no dancing. I mean, the musical numbers must have been separate from everything.
Yeah.
Again, yeah, like West Side Story just
or
feels
he cut
like
all the. That's the thing. He think he cut all the bridging stuff as well, because he had to, because it made no sense. And that's probably what he reshot. He reshot the interstitial stuff as non-musical interstitial rather than musical interstitial.
Because, yeah, you couldn't have, like, Nick Nolte, like, you know, tap dancing into the room and then just cut the song out and be like, well, he still tap danced into the room.
Yeah, so they just reshot that segment, so he just walks into the room.
But, yeah, you could cut out all the musical numbers and then just have the Jets and the Sharks just walk into their scene instead of dance, you know?
Yeah.
And it would still, yeah, it would be the same thing.
Though I imagine it would be much shorter. That's the thing. This movie is like 2 hours long.
It's a conundrum, man.
How the fuck did he get a whole movie out of it?
As I say, I just want... I don't even need to see the musical version. I just want to see the camera of James... I want to see someone film James L. Brooks editing the movie. And I just want to know what was going on in his head when he's putting this whole thing together and just going, oh yeah, I don't need the songs at all. They're superfluous. Okay. My movie makes total sense without them.
And the last little bit on this is, like, they're talking about, they're watching the test screening of Mr. Deeds, and they're like, is he fuckable? They immediately go, like, that girl, she's fuckable. She wasn't that, like, any more or less fuckable than Nick Nolte, I don't think.
And Nick Nolte was, like, the sexiest man in the world. He was People's Sexiest Man, I think, in, like, 1992, and he's still prime Nick Nolte, so,
yeah.
I mean, if he's
this
People's
is,
Sexiest Man.
This is
man,
still Grace Quigley.
Yeah.
Nick Nolte.
I mean, is that a commentary on people not thinking this Nick Nolte's sexy?
I don't... And that's
like,
the
they
thing.
Have the
Did
the
you notice that
man?
Nick Nolte's character, it seemed like they went out of their way not to make him a bad guy at all. Like, at first he's a really bad guy because he fucked off on his daughter and, like, never visited her, I guess. But then throughout the movie, there's moments where, like, he should be... Like, he would have reason to be an asshole, and then he's like, no, I'm fine. Or like, oh, I'm still a nice guy.
Well, yeah, and because that's another thing with the movie. There's no complications with him raising the daughter. And,
like, he never really raises his voice to her. I mean, maybe once, but, like, it's like... There's never a moment where, like, he gets to the point where it's like, I hate having this kid.
No.
Like he would in a normal drama.
Well, he starts there is the weird thing. He starts there and then immediately drops it and he's fine with the kid.
Yeah.
Because he drops off the kid at the neighbor ladies the first fucking day.
Yeah.
And then he's already, like, flabbergasted. But after that moment, not flabbergasted at all. There's never any moment where he's like, ugh, what am I going to do with this kid? They live in a one-bedroom apartment, and that's not even a thing.
No.
She sleeps in a fucking sleeping bag, doesn't go to school, and that's not the plot of the movie.
You'd
the plot of the movie is not, let's put this kid in fucking school and get her a bed.
You would think that if a kid is given custody to a parent that they hadn't been in custody with for years because of another parent going to prison, that social services would be involved and check up on the kid to make sure that he was ready to be a parent.
Absolutely. Well, because you're basically giving a child to a stranger. I mean, even though, yes, biologically, Nick Nolte's the father.
Not only a stranger, but a stranger who has good reason to not want that kid because they left.
Right. If he's a deadbeat fucking dad and doesn't, you know... Also, can he? They just give the kid to him legally?
I think that would be the first one they would call and say, hey, you're the next of kin.
I guess he's still the legal guardian, yeah.
But again, we established in the first scene that they never told them that.
Right.
He thought he was just staying with her for like 3 weeks.
Right. Legally, could he say, no, like, I haven't had this kid in 2 years?
You'd think he'd have to sign some papers to be her legal guardian.
Right. But no, they have him fly to Tracy Ullman's house. Tracy Ullman goes, I'm going to prison. They slap the cuffs on her. Give him a kid forever. Here, this is your child for the rest of their life. Like, yeah, this isn't like, oh, hold this until she gets back.
Yeah.
Like, this lady's going away for a couple years.
And he's unemployed at the start
exactly.
of that.
Exactly!
So he can't care for her. He can't afford to feed her.
Don't just give people children, I think is the moral of I'll Do Anything. If we have learned anything from today's podcast, don't just give someone a child.
Or just don't give Nick Nolte a child.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can give Nick Nolte a child because he's so sweet with them. Those sweet little moments with daddy and daughter. All right, so
pulling from the hat. The hat now only has, for right now, the Five Timers Club.
Yeah, I figure we went through a whole hat. If this is your first podcast, congratulations, because...
And I'm sorry.
This was a weird one.
Well, if this is your first podcast ever, then I'm fine with it. You've got a lot of ways to go.
You think there's one guy out there...
You know, I'm interested in this whole podcasting thing.
Finds an iPod in the desert and goes, huh, podcast? What's that? Well, maybe I'll just peruse Saturday Night Live.
Well, I think he looked for Saturday Night Live, he misspelled it, and then found us.
And then he went, huh, episode 147. There's a good place to start.
Well, he doesn't know how podcasts work. He doesn't know that you're supposed to start at episode one. And I know a lot of people that don't. A lot of people start with the current episode.
I'm going to find the most obscure thing I can and start in the middle. What an interesting fellow you are. All right, so no. We went through an entire hat full of names of SNL cast members. And since we did that, I just put the Five Timers in this hat. Also, because I didn't want to fucking write down 157 names again.
Well, we'll do it eventually.
I know.
By next week.
I don't know why I just don't want to do that. I'm like, I don't want to go through the list, write down the names. So there's only like maybe 20 in this hat. So our next 20 episodes will be from the SNL.
I assumed you'd probably have it by next week and load it in. But I guess you just want to do the Five Timers.
Yeah, let's just get rid of all the Five Timers in a row. All
right, fine.
So our first Five Timer will be...
Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, man.
I know what movie we're watching.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Oh, shit. Yeah, fuck. I was going to say, oh, she hasn't done anything bad, has she? And then five movies just popped in my head of like, oh perfect.
Well, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking things like fucking Tammy.
Okay, because I'm thinking of, have you heard of Cook-Off?
I have heard
of it. It was
that.
A movie that was filmed before she was famous in like 2005.
And it came out like 7 years
after. And it only was
released after.
Last year.
Yeah.
And it's, I believe, written and directed, or at least directed by Larry Anderson, I think?
Larry, I don't know who that is.
Or no, Larry Anderson. What am I thinking of? Fat guy from
Louis Anderson.
Louis Anderson.
Oh, I did not know that.
And it looks terrible.
Okay, I remember seeing a movie that like came out last year, and I was like, wait, what? And I was like, oh, this movie was filmed like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that's an impressive cast for a comedy.
And it's got like all the people in Reno 911, like back when they were in Reno 911.
Right,
in it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just looks so fucking weird. And that's my suggestion.
That might be a good one. But yeah, so there's definitely something we could do with Melissa McCarthy. Would you like to pause and tease?
Sure, let's see.
Okay,
let's
pause and come up with a good couple of alternatives. And we're hat.
That, by the way, for the person listening to this for the first time, that's the thing he says. It's not an accident. It's
no, you're talking to no one. This isn't a real person. And if he is, I would love to meet him. So
see,
yes,
I like that you say we're talking to no one, and you take that to mean the one person I'm talking about. I take that to mean no one listens to this podcast. What is the email address again? Can people email in and if they listen? Is anybody out there?
No, I got shut down because I put too much shit on YouTube. I was using the Saturday Night Jive podcast at gmail.com address to pirate shit on YouTube, and it got shut down.
You could have literally used anything. You used the podcast that is the email that's attached to the thing you do.
Yeah. It's like watching porn on your work computer. Yeah. Don't shit where you eat.
But no.
Don't use the email to your podcast to pirate shit on YouTube, man, and get 3 strikes.
But anyway, we talked about cook-off before we broke, but we found something better. Pumpkin from 2002. It's a movie about Christina Ricci falling in love with a mentally challenged boy.
And
I've wanted to see it for years.
Yeah, do you think it's... is it a comedy? It says comedy, drama, romance from the IMDb. This is another one where I'm just interested in what the tone is.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a movie where, like, she falls in love with a retarded guy and it's played for laughs? Or... if it's the opposite, if it's played for sincerity...
either way, it's wrong.
That's almost worse.
Like, this is like I Am Sam level, I think.
Yeah. Just thinking about the plot of Pumpkin like makes me go, there's no way that this movie can be not wrong. So yes, I'm very interested to watch it.
Yeah, so that's going to be next week, Pumpkin. And I've ordered Working Trash on DVD from Amazon, so it's going to be here next week too, so...
all right, so until next week, and probably some more off-color jokes. But
that's how are we going to resist? You just said the R word. I tried to at least go with mentally challenged, but it's like when we watched anything with a little person in it, the M word eventually comes out.
Well, I'll apologize to the person who finds a random podcast and starts with...
because he is mentally challenged.
Starts with that episode. Because this one must be about me.
If he's listening to this podcast, he must be mentally challenged.
All right, Pumpkin is my favorite movie and my favorite food. Better not eat this iPod, though.
Okay, we're already done trying to be sensitive about it.
All right, see you next week.
Get off
get
the
off
shed.
This shed.
That's the thing we say at the end of the podcast.
Get off the shed.
Get off the shed. Yeah.